Welcome to Pet Food Advisors. I'm Tracy Hotchner, here with my co-host, Dr. Sean Delaney, a veterinary nutritionist whose company, Balance It, is sought after by pet owners and veterinarians across the world for advice about personalized, optimal nutrition for cats and dogs. This show offers well-researched, objective information about pet nutrition, from home cooking to the pet food industry, so you can make thoughtful decisions about feeding your own dogs and cats. Feel free to email me at radiopetlady@gmail.com if you have any questions or topics you'd like Dr. Sean to cover. This show is a production of 8paws LLC and DVM Consulting, Inc., which are solely responsible for its content.
Dr. Sean Delaney is back from the Netherlands, where he talked to all kinds of pet food smarties like himself. And Dr. Sean, I would love to know what's going on in Europe, because it isn't just the Netherlands, it's Europe in general, right, that meets at this pet food gathering to talk about the present and the future.
Yeah, it was a nice gathering I've never been able to go to before. It was the European Society's Congress, as they call it. That's kind of their term for a meeting or a symposium or a conference,
right,
that's used typically in Europe. And they have it annually. It's hosted typically at different veterinary schools, and it's mainly the attendees are folks that are in the European pet food industry, but with a nutrition slant. So they're, you know, people on the technical side of things for the most part, and then the different academics. So other boarded nutritionists. So there's a European College of Nutrition, as well as there's an American college. They're a smaller and newer college, but they have, I think, about 30 members or so, and the vast majority of them were there as well. And because we are a small entity of boarded nutritionists in the world, and those are the only two specialty colleges, we know a lot of each other. We know each other quite well and cross the pond, as they say, frequently. So it was good to see my European colleagues, if you will, and hear how things were going in Europe, and also get, you know, a lot of interesting takes on nutrition. We touched upon in our last show about one of the talks about using bugs as a protein source. I was asked to talk about mineral and vitamin fortification in pet food as a keynote speech. And it was very nice. It was supported by DSM, which is the old Roche that makes vitamins. I didn't have any specific obligation to them. They just funded that talk, and so they paid the money to the Congress and then paid for my flight over, if you will. So anyway, it was an interesting opportunity to kind of take a step back and talk a little bit about, you know, the rationale and some of the things that we're doing. And one of the interesting aspects of being there was certainly a focus in the Europeans of sustainability. They don't have a lot more land mass, and they're a pretty mature market. And so there was a talk about sustainability and what does that look like as the population grows elsewhere in the world and there's competition for resources. And so I took a look at where the market is going, if you will, and also a little bit about sustainability and some of the choices we're making and I think made an interesting discussion about the fact that as we go to less byproduct and that we use deboned meat and we put that higher on our list, that, you know, it's obviously not necessarily the most environmentally friendly decision because of feed conversion. A more vegetarian diet is easier on the planet, if you will, which we've talked about before. But also that it's going away from maybe even a natural approach to feeding. And so, you know, we exsanguinate, we eviscerate, and we debone our meat. And those three things, the EED, if you will.
Called that in the profession?
No, that's just my term.
Interesting. So we exsanguinate, we remove all the blood. Eviscerate,
we remove
the organs.
We eviscerate all the internal organs, and we debone. And
wow.
In doing so, those, a lot of nutrients are lost because that's a repository for a lot of nutrients. And we don't think about that. But, you know, we have this tendency of late to not want to have byproduct, which really means getting rid of things like liver, which is a wonderful source of vitamins and trace minerals. We exsanguinate, which is the major source for a lot of the electrolyte macro minerals, things like salt, chloride, you know, magnesium, potassium. We get rid of that, and we debone, which also gets rid of a lot of minerals, especially, as we all know, calcium and phosphorus. And so a lot of the fortification that is needed, and it is done in part, is related to the inherent way we slaughter and process our foodstuffs. And as we go and want to feed more and more like we like to feed ourselves and avoid those ingredients in our pet food for a variety of reasons, it just puts even more pressure on pet food. We couple that with the aspects that have always existed with prepared food, which is shelf life stability, and I talked about that, and the effects that has on vitamin degradation and the cooking process. When you're not feeding raw, you're, you know, vitamins are very heat labile and also are destroyed by the presence of minerals. And so there's a lot of need for vitamin fortification to correct for that destruction, you know, with cooking and processing and also with time. But what's interesting to me about that is it just opened this kind of discussion, if you will, about, you know, some of the things of our quote most natural foods, our grain-free foods, are somewhat in the greatest need of being fortified at times. And you say, well, what about the grain-free? Well, you know, if we transfer from using a whole grain, you know, let's say we're using whole brown rice and we switch to using tapioca or tapioca starch, to make a grain-free product, we lose a lot of B vitamins that are on the outside of a grain that we could otherwise have. And not that that's enough to fortify the diet completely. It is interesting as we think about some of these, you know, quote, more healthy, more natural choices, does increase the need for purified vitamins and minerals and more fortification, which is the antithesis to many people of a more natural approach or a whole food feeding regimen.
Well, what really strikes me is how short-sighted many of us are, because while these issues of treading lighter on the planet and trying to be more of locavores and try to not eat foods that are out of season or come from far away and try and eat things that are kind of natural to your environment in the right season and in their most whole state so you get the most nutrition out of them, but we really don't stop and say, but we the consumer are making often emotional and not very intelligent or far-sighted requests, which is that we want this only the creme de la creme, the fillet of everything in our pet food. And we're throwing out the bathwater, which is where a lot of the value, the food value, is in the bathwater. So we're saying we just want to eat the baby, to go with that kind of strange idea. But it's not don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We're in the growing of animals, all their body parts, their blood and their organs and their stomach lining and their, I mean, and not to mention their bones, aren't just full of vitamins and minerals, but they're full of ones that are specifically valuable to dogs and cats. So has our pendulum swung so far that we've kind of lost our sense?
I don't know if we've lost our sense. I just think that it is a reminder to all of us that sometimes marketing and science don't align.
That's a very good way of putting it, because byproducts, a lovely piece of butcher quality that you and I, if people still ate liver back in the days when we all had calves liver once a week because, you know, our grandparents thought it was good for us, that's as equally a byproduct as some weird intestinal thing with fecal matter in it. And I mean, by what the AFCO, and I'm not going to ask you which page it's on, but isn't the description of a byproduct as any of those organs? And unfortunately, many of them are kind of dirty. They're handled dirty, or they're dirty to begin with. They don't have to be, but that's sort of how the remnants of the human food industry, at least in my understanding of it, those things become handled with much less care in terms of food safety or even what's clinging to them or touching them. And so we've come to see byproduct as a dirty word.
Right. And I think that byproduct is a very general term. And I think you sometimes see that people who are most adamant about byproduct, just the word byproduct, will still be accepting of if they see the word liver.
That's right.
So if it says beef liver, and sometimes you kind of scratch your head at that. But I think what they're trying to avoid is the other stuff that they don't like, whether that may be intestinal tract components. But there's also people who don't like the idea of feeding liver because that is a body's filter for toxins.
It is.
And so
it is.
They think, why would I want to feed the concentrated source of all the toxins that some other animal has cleared out of their bloodstream before they even, you know, had it go into their body? And so there's this interesting, you know, I guess, aspect that we forget that everything has its good and bad points, and nothing is unfortunately all perfect, because if it was perfect, we probably would have settled on that being the optimum way to feed. And we just haven't gotten there. And so purified nutrients, usually why people are, you know, not a fan of, which we talked about before, is that their bioavailability sometimes is not as great. how much you get out of it. And so there's, you know, sometimes a debate about that. Sometimes people like the idea that it's just from a more natural approach, the proportions. But the proportions that sometimes come also have some drawbacks. You know, I've done work pro bono in India and Africa where commercial pet food wasn't available and tried to formulate whole food recipes. And often that relies on using a tremendous amount of organ meat. And in doing so, I push what we feel is a safe level of certain fat-soluble vitamins at times because I have to use so much of, let's say, liver to meet other nutrient needs. And so it can be really a trade-off. And you say, well, what about in nature? Why does this occur? And I was having a conversation actually before I started doing the show with a veterinarian who wanted some advice on a local book that he puts together where he has kind of a whole foods approach. And I reminded him that, you know, there's some nice work in looking at how wolves have been reintroduced into Yellowstone and their lifespan. And we've touched upon this before. And if your desire is to produce a few litters before you die at 2 or 3 years of age, your nutrient needs and probably what's optimum for you is very different than an animal that's spayed and is going to live to be 15 years old.
Right.
And we forget that. And so having massive excessive amounts, we see it, of fat-soluble vitamins may be not so troubling because you're often producing litters where you're pouring those nutrients, if you will, through milk and
right.
through their growth in back into them. And that's a way to have that escape from you. Plus, maybe some of these things take 3, 4, 5 years. You know, some of the cats that are on an all-liver diet, it takes many years before some of the bone changes occur and the spine problems they have. And so maybe in a normal environment that live a year or two because they, you know, get predated or they aren't as efficient of a hunter anymore, then it doesn't really matter what happens at 10 years out because you're not alive at 10 years out. So
now you mentioned an all liver diet for cats. Is that a feeding program that is done in a research sense, giving cats only liver to see what happens?
No, it's a classic presentation that you learn in vet school because people will used to do that. They used to just feed liver. And so it'd be a classic presentation where basically cats couldn't move their head very much.
Oh my.
And what happens is that with excessive vitamin A levels, especially if there's also concurrently low vitamin D levels. Interesting, we still study some of this work in a controlled setting that one of the main folks that put on the Congress I was at, his name is Ron Corby. He just finished his dissertation, and one of his papers was looking at the effect of vitamin A excess in conjunction with not having enough vitamin D and suggesting that some of the levels on the safe upper levels that we've set for cats is actually still too high and that the lower levels are needed because there's already very significant bone changes that occur, skeletal changes occur. But basically what happens is the spine starts to fuse, if you will, with
wow.
this excess. And so a classic presentation that you learn about, and this is probably from the 50s and 60s that you still get trained with vitamin A hypervitaminosis, basically this changes on their spinal processes and basically these fusing, if you will, of their spinal cord and their inability to turn as much as they could, most manifested in their neck. And so it wasn't something that someone induced.
I see.
It was something that happened with people's feeding approaches that they figured out subsequently. And it's still of interest enough and becomes more of an interest as we, you know, look at, you know, feeding high meat, high organ meat diets.
Right.
That someone just finishing their PhD has done work in that area in 2014.
So people used to, when cats live mostly outdoors, and let's say they were barn kitties or mousers of some kind, what owned cats were fed was liver. Like if I recall back in the 50s, 60s, even 70s, liver, chicken or beef or calf was pretty inexpensive. And that was something that people fed to pets. Was it fed as a cat food by people?
It was. And the issue wasn't so much that if it was occasionally fed, it was the exclusive feeding
I'll
of
be
it.
Darned.
As we've talked about before, cats will fixate on a specific food. And so
yes.
What I don't know is if we were to be able to go in a time machine where these cats that inherently would not eat anything else because that's what they've been exposed to and had self-selected. And even if they wanted to give them other things, they just would choose not to.
Wow.
And you have to remember that dogs and cats will often like to eat liver as a primary food source, because evolutionarily it was limited and not highly available even in the body of any prey species, and it was such a rich source of nutrients that when you could get it, you ate it.
Interesting. So there was a like a biological drive to take it in.
That's, I mean, we always have to be careful about assigning, you know, what's driving things evolutionarily, but I think you could make a strong argument that if there are essential nutrients that are richest in a particular piece of food, that you would have a drive to eat that if available. It's why we eat fat so readily, because there's twice or two, more than twice as many calories in it. So we have an inherent desire whenever fat is available to eat it, because typically there wasn't excess calories lying around. And so whenever you could get your hands on it, you eat as much fat as you
right.
could, you get as many calories as you could.
And of course, the animals that we or our ancestor dogs and cats would have been eating, they were leaner too, because they were natural animals that roamed. They weren't feedlot animals that were fattened in a short, intense period of time, right? So even the fat on those, you know, the original, never mind the settlers and their turkey, but even the turkey that our grandparents ate had, I'm sure, a fraction of the fat, the ones we eat, because ours are commercially produced.
And we've selected. We've selected for more marbling. I was just reading about how apparently the 1950s chicken took, you know, it takes a third of the less time or something like that to make the same amount of chicken breast now in the current breed or genetics of chicken. So we select for certain characteristics. So we select for marbling, we select for fattier meats. You know, we've seen that with even dairy cows. You know, Jersey cows used to be everywhere. You'd see Jersey cows, but now we don't see too many Jersey cows, and they produced a very rich milk. But now it's all Holsteins, because Holsteins have an amazing amount of yield and their fat content's not as crucial. We don't have, I think, as much of a drive for cream and butter and whole fat milk. And so total amounts of gallons produced per cow is really where things are focused on. So you go out, at least in California, and I was surprised when I was driving the Netherlands on my way from Amsterdam to Utrecht, there was Holsteins everywhere. It was all Holsteins.
You see a Holstein, you think, low-fat milk. The rest of us think,
large amounts of lower-fat milk.
Right, exactly. And of course, we don't know that the human body or mind is actually not craving the fat. We've been all taught it by human nutritionists who have been on a low-fat bandwagon for so long that there are people that will only eat a low-fat cheese, a low-fat or a zero-fat yogurt, a zero-fat milk. I'm not entirely convinced that is the smartest move for everybody in terms of their health or something, but it's certainly something that's been taught as if it's fact and indisputable.
Well,
so,
there's fat phobia. There is certainly a fat phobia.
Yes.
And I think that we have to recognize that. And I certainly think that maybe a better placed fear is fatty acid phobia. I think that what we probably should spend more of our time is maybe worrying about the type of fatty acids we're consuming rather than just the type of fat.
Yes.
And I think we've seen that slowly as people talk about, you know, nuts and fats from, you know, legumes, all of those being a much more healthful choice, and maybe not worrying about just a global fat period is bad. Yes, lots of N6 fatty acids, lots of, you know, saturated fat, those are really, really bad for us. We probably don't have any argument, but not all fats are rich in N6 fatty acids and are saturated. And so I think that's, to your point, painting with broad strokes sometimes then leads to interesting changes, which is here's, you know, a breed of cow that is very common because it produces a milk that meets the demand that we currently have. And, you know, when I was in vet school, a little off the sidetrack, but I think it's interesting, there was we had a dairy on the school premises. It's still there at UC Davis. It's right in the midst of everything. And there was always one or two Jersey cows. And the reason, amongst 100, you know, or so or more Holsteins.
Wow.
And it was kind of funny because if you don't know Jerseys versus Holstein, Jerseys are much smaller cows. And they're physically smaller. And so they kind of are, you know, dwarfed by all these other Holsteins in their, you know, tan kind of color compared to these black and white splotched Holsteins. If you're not familiar with a Holstein, is the black
right.
and white cow you always see. And And the reason they did that was just so that us vet students, mainly, and also folks in animal science, would at least know what another cow looked
like. Oh, how funny. That's how proliferate, how much Holstein's proliferated for all somebody might know. That's what every cow in the world looked like.
That's exactly right.
That's why they should go to state fairs like we have in Vermont and states like, you know, there's all these different colors and sizes and shapes of cattle. And they're beautiful, some of them.
And some of those dairymen, you know, it's what I would think I'd want jerseys, because if you're producing a really high grade milk that someone who wants, you know, probably the full fat, Jersey cow's a superior animal in that regard. And it's a sweet cow. I mean, not to say Holsteins aren't, but it's a lot easier to handle because it's physically a lot smaller.
Yes.
You know, and so there's a lot of things to be said for that, and why, you know, here out in California, we have these mega dairies with 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 head of cows. You know, no one single dairyman could handle that. And so, you know, a lot of times in Vermont, I hear, and upper New York, you know, they have maybe at most 150, 200 head of cows, because that's what a single family can handle, or maybe with a few farmers.
A few hands, yeah, or make some more children to help out on the farm. But I guess, you know, people worry also, then they get confused and worry about giving fatty foods to their dogs and cats, and dogs have a really high need for fat. I mean, cats too, for that matter. I mean, dietary fat is, they need more of it than we need. Like, they need more calcium, right?
Well, I don't know that they need more. I've never really done a direct comparison. I would say that they certainly naturally, especially cats, eat more of it than we do. And they certainly can process and handle it a lot better. Their ability, and especially cats, to do gluconeogenesis, which is just a really fancy word for producing sugar from amino acids and fatty acids, is really, really good. You and I, and we've touched upon this many moons ago, have a real hard time on an Atkins diet sustaining blood sugar levels.
Ah.
And so start producing ketones. When we are on a basically no or low carb diet, sometimes referred to the induction phase of Atkins, if you will, or a low carb diet. A cat you can put on a no carb diet and they never bothers them. They can maintain their blood sugar levels without any problem whatsoever because they're adapted to that. They can convert amino acids and fatty acids into needed blood glucose without any problem whatsoever. They can very rarely would they ever go into a ketotic state, and the only time you see ketones in cats is when they're diabetics. So
which often happens as a result of having fed them a lot of carbohydrates.
It all interrelates in some way.
Yes.
But I guess I'll go back to what was interesting in the Netherlands and being in Europe is that, you know, they stay deal with a lot of the same issues we deal here with in North America. I'll use that phrase. But they also have some unique issues. They have a shrinking population. They don't have any ability to really expand in any new area or land. It's all been developed and been developed for many, many decades, if not centuries. And so they, you know, are focused very much on sustainability. They're very focused on food quality. They're focused on, it seems now, recognizing that they need to go and reach out to developing countries to sell their knowledge, whether that be, you know, actual intellectual property, whether that be equipment, very high tech things that they can do. And they're spending, in talking to some of the other folks that were speaking, they're spending more and more of their time making trips to South America, to Asia, to these places to really identify these markets that are now growing and providing opportunities that just are no longer present in Europe. And the analogy that one of the individuals was from the animal science food production side of things was saying, you know, if we want to get a plant that's going to make, you know, some agricultural product, we'll spend 3, 4, 5 years just on the permitting process in Europe, and it may be 10 or 20% of the overall cost of the entire project. And he goes, you contrast that with the situation in South America or China, and it's months in a fraction of what you're looking at. And so they're very developed, very controlling, I think would be the right word. Government is also having an impact in their ability to grow and to flourish, they feel. And they almost, there was an undertone of overregulation occurring.
Yes. And it's certainly the other end of the pendulum, where at least our perception externally about China in particular is not just how lax their rules are, but there's a total lack of them. And it may be kind of what would be equivalent to a Wild West Cowboys phase in our growth and development as a nation in America, where anything went as people pushed westward and took land and killed the natives and ate the buffalo and kept on moving west till they reached the water. And there weren't rules about so many things until things settled down.
Right. And what I think is interesting is that you're seeing maybe a cross-pollinating of cultures where the Chinese with Europeans, North Americans, you know, I'll include other developed countries, Japan, they're recognizing that, you know, not to say that I think that the, globally it's in China that it's completely a Wild West, but they're realizing that they can't be without regulation and they can't be without quality. But they also, at the same time, the Europeans are recognizing we can't be to the point where we're stagnating and that we can't have any change because that's not going to work either. And so I think with our global economy and our global world we live in, it's interesting to see, you know, these very two probably large ends of the extreme. And I think we're going to come to some place in the middle, ultimately. And hopefully that'll be a place where, you know, it works for everyone.
But it is interesting to think that in Europe, at least my personal experience living there on and off for my whole life, there's many fewer owned animals. Cats are more of what they consider village dogs in other parts of the world. Cats are mostly unowned, or they appear to be. And while there aren't in most parts of Europe unowned village dogs or street dogs, there really aren't that many owned dogs. You don't see them behind a fence. You don't see them much on a leash. I mean, Paris is famous for being such a dog-friendly city, but all you see is a massive amount of poo on the sidewalks because they're anarchists and don't think they're meant to clean up after themselves. And while you can take a dog into many restaurants, you can't take them into any hotels. So they're not really the concept of the dog-friendly culture, I think, really would be more America at this point than there. But it's not as though as those countries have grown or matured or gotten more modern that there are more pets in people's lives. Whereas in these other countries, they've barely scratched the surface of how many pets people would like to have and have never had the experience of it.
Yeah, I think I don't know what the stats are, but I saw some Euromonitor data, which kind of tracks things when I was in Shanghai, and they compare the growth rates, and it's extremely flat in Europe. And for, you know, pet food products, pets, population, all the different, you know, metrics that you could have. There's still some growth, but most of the growth in North America is related to just organic growth as people pick more and more premium options.
Yep.
So it's not that there's more animals. It's just that maybe they're going to spend a little bit more on the products than they did before. And that's where the growth is coming from. But the real growth and the real dynamics and where the real opportunity is in South America and in Asia. And to that point, what's interesting to me is that I've now regularly seen Brazilians. So Brazil has a very quickly growing domestic pet food industry. And there were, at least 7 or 8 Brazilians at this meeting. There's in Sao Paulo, there is a vet school with a very good nutritionist, and he's often at the North American meetings. And now, and I found out when I saw him there as well, he brings his graduate students and his postdocs to European meetings.
Lucky them.
And that's what I said. And it's really interesting. And he's been doing some really good work. And several of his graduate students presented at this meeting their research. And it was really interesting to see, you know, how quickly that is developing and the flourishing of their pet food industry, because obviously a lot of his research is supported by industry. And the fact that they have money to be spending, which, you know, if you talk to the European academics, you talk to the American academics, they still struggle to come up with funding for a lot of research. And although pet food companies are often generous, they still are, you know, it's not generous enough to sustain a lot of programs. And it was really interesting to see here he had many graduate students, a lot of research being done. And it just really was a reflection of how I think good the times are or are becoming for, you know, some of these developing countries, Brazil being an example of.
It is funny because sort of as we wind up in America, we see ourselves as somehow the biggest country or the smartest country or the most, forward thinking. But really, there's all kinds of burgeoning markets out there for people to own pets and to take good care of them and to buy them quality products. And it's kind of important that someone like you is out there as an ambassador and can come back and tell us, wow, things are have sort of stopped in a growth phase, whether it's in information or research or numbers of pets in some areas, but they're really blossoming elsewhere. And those countries, whether it's South America or Asia, they have the benefit of everything that North Americans and Europeans have learned and what pet owners have wanted. So they're already starting at a much, they've got a real jump on us. Yeah, they've got a great head start.
They have a head start in some areas, and then they also have some challenges for sure, you know. And I think that, you know, where we talk about, you know, quality, where there's still some development is, you know, like everything, suppliers and the quality of the suppliers, because, you know, the level of human food probably hasn't been that high in some of these countries. And so by extension, the pet food hasn't been. And so they're, I think, working towards getting to the point where, how can we make our products as good of a quality as something you might get out of Europe or North America? But it won't be long if they aren't already there.
Well, I just say thank you for going there. Thank you for helping them be better, because everyone that holds themselves to that higher standard and raises the bar a little bit, it really only makes it better in the end for all of us and for what goes in the bellies of our dogs and cats. Thank you, Dr. Sean. Welcome home. I hope your travels are calmed down for a while so you can concentrate on Balance It and the wonderful new foods that you are making.
Thank you very much, Tracy. You have a great rest of your day.
You too.